The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Time now for us to check in with Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com, for a look at the week in politics. Thank you, Jim, for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome, Larry. How are you?
We're going to look back at the election. We'll talk about former President Trump announcing he's running for the White House again in 2024. Let's just listen to a clip. This is Trump speaking Tuesday night from his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. He says America's comeback starts right now.
What we have built together over the past 6 years is the greatest movement in history, because it is not about politics. It's about our love for this great country, America, and we're not going to let it fail.
All right. As he does that, the LA Times Wednesday morning comes out with the headline, Trump runs again, comma, uphill. And then it says the former president announces 2024 bid after being a drag on his party in 2022. Count on the LA Times to point out things and, kind of pick on Trump a little bit, but let's talk about it. First off, election night. Did it go as you expected it?
No, not really. And what we saw is another polling miss. And where it really was, I think, on those issues, because abortion turned out to be a much bigger driver than the polling was suggesting, because it always, this seemed to be across the board from all the pollsters, the conservative pollsters, the liberal pollsters, the Democrats, the Republicans, the universities, and the professional pollsters. They all pretty much showed the same information, and that was the economy was the dominant issue. At the end of the day, the Democratic strategy of going with a single issue on abortion and then really targeting the female suburban vote really seems to have worked. CNN has some interesting numbers, because they're showing, though, that nationally, more Republicans voted than Democrats. I mean, the Republicans won the national vote. So what that tells us, and when we look at the fact that the gains in the House were well less than expected, how do we explain that if the Republicans won the national vote? Well, the answer would be, and we'll see when we see final numbers, and this will take a while, but I would be shocked if it wasn't that the Republican turnout in their strongest areas was extremely high, but they didn't make their marks in the most competitive seats. And that's what threw some of the strength back to the Democrats. I mean, the Republicans will have a very small margin in the House now. And the Senate, of course, will be in Democratic hands no matter what happens at the Georgia runoff on December the 6th. That latter one was more expected, because the Republicans had a bad map on the Senate races. As you know,
you talked about that before. I mean, that's not something you...
Right.
No surprises there. If people listened to you on my show, they knew that the Senate was going to be a tough one no matter what.
Yes. Yes. And so it ended up the Nevada seat going and staying with the Democrats really was the crowning glory for the Democrats that gave them the 50 seats they need. And now the Georgia runoff between Senator Raphael Warnock and Herschel Walker will simply be, is it going to be a 50-50 Senate if Walker wins, or 51-49 if Warnock wins? But either way, the Democrats will be in control of the Senate.
Yeah, but if you don't have the House and you only have the Senate, there is somewhat of a firewall put in place, but not as good as you had wanted. Let's talk about theories here. One theory is, like you said, the abortion issue was stronger than thought. Another one is that establishment Republicans who funded much of the races in the Senate put their money on establishment candidates and squeezed out Trump-backed candidates. Is that possible?
Oh, to a degree it is. But, you know, the other one, and I do think Trump deserves some criticism for this, his political action committee raised well over $200 million, yet only approximately $15 million found its way into helping candidates. And that's why people were contributing to that. So I think he deserves some criticism for that. It wasn't just the establishment Republicans, i.e. Mitch McConnell, suggesting that money not go into the Arizona race, for example. I mean, at the end of the day, they came back and funded that race. But where I think the establishment gets some criticism or should have some is that they threw, I think it was $9 million to help Lisa Murkowski when she was actually in a race against another Republican in that new system they have there in Alaska. That didn't have anything to do with the party division in the Senate. What that had to do with was a vote for Mitch McConnell for the conference leader. And so that, I think, he should be criticized for, just as Trump should be criticized for not spending more money to help some of these candidates that he, first of all, endorsed, supported, and then, and in some cases, recruited. But they weren't seeing much of any of that money that he was raising, and it was a substantial amount, and I think that affected some things.
What about ground game? There are others who say the problem is Democrats changed the rules and made these elections month-long, mm-hmm. and you work to get out the vote, and you get them to turn in their absentee ballots, and they did that, and Republicans still haven't figured out that if they're going to win elections, they have to have a ground game, go around, gather up all the possible ballots, follow up to make sure they're in, and de-emphasize Election Day. Get them in, whatever you have to do. Pick them up, you know, go do that. Is that a problem for Republicans? They're just not figuring out how to play the game.
It certainly seems so. They seem to be a little bit, they're definitely behind the Democrats in the organizational standpoint. I mean, that's why the Democrats want all these changes in the election system. There really isn't any reason why we have to have all these changes, that we have to have a month of early voting and now a month to count the ballots. And what they really want, of course, is that ballot harvesting where they can go out and just collect ballots. So, you know, they fought a lot of that. I expect that the Democrats, now continuing to control the Senate, they're going to move on what we would call SR1, which is the election, what they call the election reform bill. It's really the no voter ID bill, and they will try to push that through again. Now, I don't think we'll see much of a move on the filibuster rules this time, because if Republicans are in control of the House, then the filibuster really becomes moot, because the Republicans can stop it theoretically. But keep in mind, the Democrats are only going to need a couple of Republicans on all these votes in the House to get their agenda through, and it's not out of the realm of possibility they could get some at certain points. Yeah. The elections bill would be one that I'd be concerned with, because, you know, Republicans have a history of going along, some of them, and they won't need many, with some of these so-called reforms, because they think, oh, the press will attack me if I don't vote for this. I mean, we saw that on the McCain-Feingold situation 20 years ago, when they changed the whole campaign financing to the Republicans' detriment. And why were you supporting something that was changing the rules to your disadvantage? And that's generally the reason, because they think they get attacked for not doing it. And I think we'll see some of that again. So I don't think we're out of the woods on this voter ID bill, or the no voter ID bill.
Mistake for Republicans to cave and support in strong numbers the infrastructure bill? It gave Democrats a win that they could campaign on. Why did they do that?
Well, yes, it certainly did give them a win. And when, of course, they call it the Inflation Reduction Act, which is absurd, because it does the exact opposite. Yeah, I think these individual members that voted for that, I frankly think they were getting something out of it for their districts in the House. And that was the main reason that drove them to do that. So it's, you know, those votes tend to be complicated, and sometimes it breaks down party labels. If there's a big project you've been working for and it's in this bill, it's hard not to support something like that that would fund what you've been working for. So you have that dynamic involved.
Right. You were watching the California congressional races, and yes, it appears that some of the key ones were indeed won by Republicans, but others not so. This drawn-out vote counting process makes it difficult to always pin everything down, but what's your analysis of the California contingent in the House?
Well, again, we've got the majority of these outstanding races are from California because of the long counting process that the state allows the counties 33 days to count these ballots and to certify, and they have such a long time where ballots can still come in, supposedly postmarked on Election Day, and of course the overseas ballots that come in after the election. Now, most states have that, but it's just this long, drawn-out process that takes a month to vote and a month to count now. So we'll see what the final numbers are, but it's going to be just in the these House races a very small Republican majority, and the California seats played a major role in that.
Right. At the time we're taping, Calvert is back up, and they're considering that probably a win for him, but he was down election night. Mike Garcia?
Yes, Calvert was projected a winner. At the time we're taping this, Garcia is well ahead but not projected. David Valadao up in the Fresno area is ahead but not projected. There's another seat that I think is definitely going to come the Republicans' way. It's in the Sacramento area that comes all the way down into Southern California along the Nevada border. This new third district, it's an open seat. It's rated as an R+8. That should end up in the Republican column.
And then what about the, you mentioned the new Speaker of the House, McCarthy. He doesn't get a commanding win, but he gets it. But you have to be able to build consensus. And when you have, as you mentioned, so few extras to count on your side, it makes it difficult in having a bold agenda.
Well, this vote for Speaker on January 3rd could be interesting because, you know, if he has a 3-vote margin, say, and he 31 members of the conference voted for somebody else in the secret ballot. So the secret ballot to elect him as the nominee for Speaker was 188-31. So the first thing he needs to do is make sure he's got all 31 of those members that didn't vote for him in line on the House vote, on the floor vote, or there could be some real interesting things happening there.
Yeah. Well, we'll watch all that and more. Jim Ellis, EllisInsight.com. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Economist Stephen Moore joins us. Stephen Moore, thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
Larry, great to be with you, too.
All right, let's get your post-mortem on the election, if we can, even though technically it's not really done yet. We're kind of getting a vision of how things turned out, but I talked to you on election night, and it was a surprise what was evolving as you turned to me and said, this is not what I expected, but I'll have to look at it. I imagine you've had some time to look. What happened? What was the result of the election compared to what you thought was supposed to happen?
Well, there's a lot there to chew over, I think. And by the way, when we talked on election night, my head was just spinning around. So, you know, because it was such a surprise. I mean, I did expect a red wave election, where I thought the voters would repudiate the Biden candidates. But frankly, that didn't happen. Incumbents won all over the country, which is weird because, you know, the exit polls showed 70 to 75% of the American people think the economy and the country is headed in the wrong direction. I happen to agree with them. But yet they still voted for the people who put the economy and the country in the wrong direction. So I'm trying to get my arms around that. But when all is said and done, the most important thing is that Nancy Pelosi is no longer Speaker of the House. And so what that means, Larry, is that we now have divided government in Washington. We've had Democrat control of all the levers of power for the last 2 years. And, you know, that didn't turn out too well for the country. And so now, even though Republicans have a razor thin majority, I thought they were going to pick up 30 seats. They picked up about 10. That it means that you will now have some checks and balances. And I think that's a good thing for the economy, good thing for the stock market, and good thing for the country. And, of course, now everybody, it's amazing, isn't it, Larry, that only a week after the midterm elections, everyone's now focused on 2024.
All right. We had former President Trump this week announce he's running for the White House in 2024, speaking Tuesday from his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. He says that President Biden must be stopped. Take a listen to this clip.
Joe Biden is the face of left-wing failure and Washington corruption.
And he promised to run a tough campaign.
I will fight like no one has ever fought before. We will defeat the radical left Democrats that are trying to destroy our country from within.
Your reaction to Trump entering again and DeSantis having a good election night, raising his prospects if he were to choose to run, and some others who might get into this?
So Trump had a brutal week, and he's being, to some extent, scapegoated for the disappointing results of the Republicans. I think he does deserve some of the blame. It is true that the Trump candidates did much more poorly than the non-Trump candidates. However, I think the Republican Party has some deeper problems than that. And so, you know, I thought the speech that Donald Trump gave last night was fabulous. I thought it was, he was not a madman. You know, he was acting very measured, but he laid out, Larry, the contrast between his policies and what they did for the country, whether it was the border, whether it was the economy, whether it was helping minorities, whether it was fighting crime, whether it was producing American oil and gas, and really contrasted that with the absolutely abysmal policies of this administration. I thought it was quite effective. And look, Donald Trump, it's an uphill climb for him. His brand has been damaged, no question about it. Often, and I work for Donald Trump, I love the man, but he truly is his own worst enemy sometimes. And so my feeling is, as a Republican, let them all on the stage like we did in 2016 and may the best man or woman win. And so, you know, it is time for, you know, Ron DeSantis, and whether it's Tim Scott or so many of these other people who are thinking about running, let's see how they perform in the primary process. I think it's a healthy thing for the Republicans. And by the way, you know, Lord knows who the Democrat is going to be at this point. It looks like Biden may run for reelection. But I think that let the process work. And I know people feel very strongly about Trump, and some people think he's just too toxic. I'm not there yet. I think he could be the nominee. And I think the other thing is, when people say, well, Trump can't win, Larry, do you remember them saying that about when he ran against Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, they said he couldn't win, and he did, very, very much so. You know, one of the things we're learning, let's talk about the Fetterman win over there in Pennsylvania. Obviously, there were a lot of things going on. Some said that the Republican candidate, Oz, wasn't necessarily the strongest choice to be running against it. Others say, look, you vote for the ideology. The person is just the embodiment of who carries it. And just like with the Biden, if he were to run for reelection, don't count him out just because he seems a little doddering and stumbles a bit. People who believe one thing are still going to believe that thing. And if they back that concept, they'll vote for the guy. I mean, that's what we have to understand here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, Larry, you are precisely right. You know, it's our voting patterns have become very tribal. In other words, you know, here you have a president of the United States who, let's face it, he's one of the worst presidents in modern history in terms of his record. What he has done to the country has been abysmal. And yet very, very few people who voted for Trump, for Biden in 2020 voted against the Democrats in 2022. They weren't shaken from the tree. And you know, by the way, Republicans who voted, you know, for Republican in 2016 and 2020 voted Republican. So there wasn't a lot of change, because it is a kind of tribal thing. You stick with the people that you feel comfortable with. And that's, I think, how Fetterman won. I mean, I think it's an embarrassment, frankly, to the state of Pennsylvania that they would elect someone like Fetterman, not just because of his state of his mental health, but also because he has crazy lunatic ideas. And yet I think people who vote Democrat feel comfortable with the Democratic Party, and that's why he won. And you know, it pains me to say that, because I don't think he's qualified to be in the United States Senate, but you know, that let the voters decide.
Yeah, you are one who watches the economy. What does divided government necessarily mean for the markets? Are we expecting things to shoot up wildly, or not so much? Is everything got to be tempered? What would be your forecast for how we take this election and go to our investments or our wallets?
Well, that's a great question. Now, as I just said earlier, you know, divided government is usually good for the stock market. It's usually good for the economy because you get the checks and balances. So that's a positive thing. And I think it's the most important, a takeaway from what happened on Tuesday night of last week. But I'm worried about the economy, Larry. I mean, you and I have had this conversation. You can't add $4 trillion of debt, as Biden has done with this massive, you know, spending. And you can't, you know, look at the consumer debt numbers. You know, the credit card debt is up to $1 trillion. We've seen the biggest gain in increase in consumer debt in 20 years. So what's happening is consumers are not cutting back on their spending. In fact, we found that out in a new report that came out today. Consumers are still spending, but they're spending by going further into debt. And we're becoming debt nation. And that worries me because it's something you can't keep running. I don't know if you can do it in Larry, in your family, but the Moore family, we can't keep running up our credit card month after month thinking that that's going to have a happy ending. And that's yet what many consumers are doing and what the United States government is doing. I mean, our credit card debt now at the federal level is $30 trillion.
Yeah. In the Marino family, we like to pay our credit cards off every single month and not be hit with any sort of fees. In fact, we turn it over. Like that. By the way,
because they'll charge it.
They'll 10%. Charge you a lot. Yeah, exactly. I was in a bank the other day, and they were, you know, how they've been giving, you know, 0.0001% maximizer accounts, and they always talk about jumbo this. Well, they're finally, you know, responding to the Fed, and I got a flyer saying you can get 4%.
Yeah, right.
I remember when you remember in Carter days when, I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, but I was getting 7% and 8% back in those days.
Yeah, I working at a bank as a bank teller in 1979, 1980, and you had banks giving lifetime CDs with interest rates at 8-9%. Now those banks went bankrupt when the inflation rate went down. But you know, this is something that's troubling. You know, we got to start paying our bills. We're living beyond our means. We're borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. So I guess the answer is I'm nervous about the economy. I think job number one in Washington has to be to bring the inflation down by cutting government spending.
Right. I mean, that's a very clear and simple plan. You can do that if you want to, but do they want to? I mean,
I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer to that one because they don't, you know, both parties love to play Santa Claus.
Exactly.
They love to sell money, but that's how we got into this crazy situation in the first place. So, you know, I was just looking at some of the numbers. You know, in 10 years, about 25 cents of every dollar we're going to be paying in taxes. You know what's going to be financing? Just the interest on the debt, Larry.
Ouch.
So that means we're not even going to get anything in return. We're just going to be paying for our past errors. And that is, as I called it, fiscal child abuse, because what we're doing is we're passing all these bills on to our children and grandchildren. And that's not what a great country does.
Yeah. In Los Angeles, in the mayor's race, it looks as if voters are bringing a lifetime politician who is a member of Congress to be mayor rather than a builder who builds things. I mean, I would have thought they would have given him a try. I mean, he spent $100 million to try to get that. In California is a crazy place. You can spend a lot of money. As you've noticed, Republicans don't seem to win the governor's mansion. And, you know, I think people have spent up to $150 million, not this time. But it's just they didn't perceive him as a Democrat and they wanted to give it to her. What's going on? Does L.A. have a passion for destroying itself?
Well, it was a very disappointing result because LA does need a businessman who just knows how to run things and not as you said, a career politician. So, we've met the enemy and the enemy is us, right? I mean, we can't complain about how terrible things are in Chicago or in Philadelphia or Los Angeles or New York and then reelect the same people and expect a different result. And so I was disappointed in that, because look, our great cities, and Los Angeles is the second largest city in America. I'm from Chicago. I go to New York all the time. It pains me to see what's happening in our great cities. They're not we used to have really great mayors like Rudy Giuliani, who really knew how to fight crime, keep taxes down, improve the schools, get rid of the graffiti. That's not happening. And, you know, you go to cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco now, and you see the homelessness, you see the trash, you see the crime. It's very, very disturbing.
Mm, but they don't connect it. I mean, a story from this past week involves a homeless person allegedly picking up two knives at a local department store and stabbing people. And yet there's no connection between that and the politicians you elect.
Yep. And that has to change. And, you know, maybe it will in 2024 because it didn't happen in 2022.
Stephen Moore, got 20 seconds here. What's that wonderful newsletter you send?
It's the Committee to Unleash Prosperity hotline. And if people want to get it, it is absolutely free, Larry. Just go to the website, Committee to Unleash Prosperity.
Stephen Moore.
Thank you, Larry. Bye-bye. Bye.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
He is the L.A. watchdog for City Watch. Jack Humphreyville is joining us as we talk elections. And, Jack, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, my pleasure, Larry. It's been a pretty exciting time over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, that's the new normal here, where elections happen, and then we wait, and then we count some, and we wait for more ballots to come in the mail. So it is really... It has really taken election night and made it into something that doesn't necessarily, you know, don't go to sleep at night thinking you know how it's going to be, because remember, Caruso was ahead as we went into to sleep after election night, and now Caruso's not ahead, right, on the mayor's race.
Yeah.
Let's start there. If indeed it turns out Caruso has spent $100 million plus and still doesn't eke out a victory, what will that mean? I know you personally mentioned you'd like to have seen him win the mayor's position.
I think Rick would have been a breath of fresh air. He, from my perspective, the major difference would be that he would have the ability to appoint a lot of people to the various boards, like the DWP board, where he'd have qualified people. Same thing with the pension boards. And I think the other thing is that he would be able to hold a number of the general. First of all, he could appoint all the general managers, and secondly, he could hold them accountable. And as you know, you would not be surprised. The city departments are not the most efficiently managed in the world. So I'm very disappointed. And I think that Karen Bass is basically Eric Point to light. I don't think she has any administrative experience. She's a lovely lady and all that kind of good stuff, but I'm not very optimistic about it.
Yeah, what does it say though about the voters, that the fact that they had this clear choice of somebody who has executive skills or go with more of the same, and they opt to go with more of the same?
I just think it's part of the city hall machine, or the Democratic machine, where. So many, you know, I forget how many people are the registration Democrats versus independents versus Republicans, but I think they have a majority, and if the Democrats don't have a majority, they're damn close to it. And I think in that regard, they get their army going and off they go.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that you might have here is the impact of the union. And, you know, when we were last talked, the scandal involving Nuri Martinez and Gil Zedillo and Kevin De Leon, they were meeting with his labor leader. And part of the tapes, or actually the Los Angeles Times had an article where this guy, Ron Herrera, the then president of the county Fed, said, we have 800,000 members. We can help finance elections. We have 20,000 people that will be out on the street at a moment's notice. And I think, you know, County Fed probably goes out there and turns on their workers and say, you know, you got to vote for Karen Bass.
Mm.
So I think, you know, I think Rick Caruso in many ways was fighting the machine.
Mitch O'Farrell on his way out as a Los Angeles City Councilman. Tuesday of this week, he conceded the race for the 13th district seat to challenger Hugo Soto Martinez. Soto Martinez was leading Farrell by more than 5,000. Farrell by more than 5,000 votes at that time. Good for a more than 55% vote. What do we know about Hugo Soto Martinez?
Well, I call him No Go Hugo, and he's one of these democratic socialists, and if you read his endorsement application for the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, he's anti-cop, he's pro-tax, rent control, way to the left, I think way to the left of, of people here in Los Angeles. We also had Eunice Hernandez was elected, replacing Gil Zedillo, and her endorsement application, she wanted to abolish the cops. So I think between, Hugo and Eunice, we're going to have we have some interesting dynamics going on. Of course, Mike Bonin is leaving, and he's leaving, and whether he's going to be replaced by Eric Darling or Park, Tracy, I think her name's Tracy Park. Tracy seems to be a moderate, and when I say moderate, I mean that in Los Angeles terms. But she seems to have her act together, whereas this guy Darling's another Democratic Socialist type. So I think we'll have some interesting dynamics on the city council, but I don't think you're going to see a real huge change, but I think you'll see some shift to the left.
L.A. County will have I'll get you in a second. L.A. County will have a new sheriff, former Long Beach Police Chief Robert Luna, defeating Sheriff Villanueva after Villanueva conceded Tuesday. Your reaction there? Probably no surprise, right?
No surprise. I mean, there was just too much drama with Villanueva. He started off wanting to hire some guy that was fired for Me Too issues. I forget exactly what it was. And the supervisors and Villanueva went to war probably like on day two of once he started being elected. And it was just, whether he was a good sheriff or not, you can debate, but there's just too much drama. Every day it was in the paper, something was going wrong there. Yeah. And whether it was he being a jerk or whether it was being the supervisors being jerks, who knows? But on the other hand, I think, I forget what the measure was. I think it was Measure A.
Measure A.
Where the supervisors would have the ability to oust the sheriff with the 80% vote. I don't know what that won by, but I think it was like 60-70%.
Pretty high margin. Some people question whether it's technically legal because of the elected nature of the offices. I don't know if anybody will challenge it, but that was pretty much put in place aimed at a chance to get a second attack on Villanueva if he won, right?
Well, I think so too. I mean, one of the other things speaking of elections, there was the city of Los Angeles elected this as controller, a kid named Kenneth Mejia, and not that we really had a good choice. It was either between Paul Koretz, who was one of the old budget busting council members, or Mejia, who has no experience. That will be very interesting. I think he's won 60% of the vote. He's a Democratic Socialist of America type, but no real world experience. He's good with a computer, but making maps. We'll see what that's going to be like. But he's threatening to, which would be good, to audit all sorts of departments, and whether he's going to do it on a political basis or an efficiency basis, will be determined. But he's pretty young. I think he's like 32 now. We'll see what happens there. The other one the one that I was excited about is the election of Heidi Feldstein as city attorney. And she, this is a lady that I've gotten to know over the last few years because of her expertise in land use stuff, land use matters, especially with regards to the state. She's smart as a whip, and I think she will, be a good city attorney, and certainly was much better than this guy named Fassel Gill, who put $2.25 million into his two campaigns, the primary and the general. I guess he's going to come up at the end. Of course, it's not $100 million like Caruso. The other ones in LA, which were money issues. One was we had a parcel tax for the parks, which was going to raise about $227 million, and I think that needed 2/3, and the city, I think it only got 40%, which surprised the heck out of me. So that one went down, flaming down. Now the other one was this initiative for ULA, which was a tax on sales of real estate north of $5 million and more, and that was at 4% starting at $1, and it increased to 5.5% once you hit $10 million. And it was dubbed the mansion tax, but my concern is that most of the people paying this, or most of the entities paying this, are going to be commercial and residential landlords. And I think that could have a very negative effect on, you know, the development of private private real estate, whether it's apartment buildings, whether it's office buildings, because it's going to have a major impact on the rates of return that investors will have. It just flabbergasted me.
I was wondering why that wasn't considered in putting this together. I mean, L.A. already has high rents, or at least people don't like it. The cost of living here is so expensive. How does that help anything? Once again, carving it. And, of course, my friends who are in the homeless services business say, okay, it's just more of the homeless industrial complex. It doesn't really solve any problems yet.
Well, it doesn't impact rent per se. Unless, you know, the landlords are able to factor it, you know, or the owners of commercial and office buildings and apartment buildings are able to factor it in, you know, in, on a monthly basis, right, if you will.
Well, I think if somebody sells their building and they have to give up 4 for 5%, and it's, you know, big tickets like over $5 million, it's going to have some impact on what you rent things for. I mean, you can't really eat the money
where it hits you is on the rate of return. And when you're you put a whole bunch of money up front and you receive rents over time, and then you sell the building, or it's worth whatever the building is at the end. But that you're going to be, it's not only a 5.5% on the total amount. It's more like 15% of your profit. And, you know, that has a major impact on the economics of your investment. And I think people will see that and they'll go, well, geez, you know, this isn't so hot. I think the other thing here is that it just sends a message that, you know, L.A. is not open for business. You know, this measure was put on the ballot basically through a bunch of the homeless industrial complex, the unions, the do-gooders, if you will, the housing advocates. And that as a result of that being an initiative, it didn't need two-thirds vote under Prop 13, but it only needed 50%. And I think that will be, my gut feel is that that will be litigated or further litigated all the way up to, again, to the Supreme Court of the state of California.
Right.
I also think that the real estate industry, people who are most affected by this, I would not be surprised for them to try and put something else on the ballot.
I would think so. You know, if you're going to play the initiative game, put something on there and kind of whack back at them. I mean, Jack, we're out of time. I wish we could talk more. We'll have you back.
See you, Larry. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Thanksgiving is this coming Thursday, and Meredith Carruthers, who is a food safety specialist, is joining us from USDA to talk everything you need to know to safely prepare that Thanksgiving meal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk turkey and other holiday prep advice. What is it, if we do a few of these things, we're going to stay safe?
Yeah. So if you follow your 4 steps to food safety, you will have a food safe Thanksgiving, which is the best type of Thanksgiving. So our 4 steps to food safety are clean, separate, cook, and chill. Clean means starting with clean hands and utensils, surfaces, and making sure you're washing those throughout food preparation. Separate is keeping your raw turkey and any other raw meat and poultry items separate from any foods that are ready to eat. This is especially important if you're preparing your big turkey and then you're also preparing some sides or things at the same time, you know, getting that charcuterie board ready for your appetizer. Keeping that separate is going to be really key and important. Cook is cooking to a safe internal temperature as measured by a food thermometer in 3 places for turkey. That's the thickest part of the breast, the innermost part of the thigh, and the innermost part of the wing. And then lastly, chill is really important when it comes to leftovers. I love Thanksgiving leftovers. I know a lot of people do too. So you want to follow a 2-hour rule. Get those leftovers in the refrigerator within 2 hours, as well as making sure that you're using them within 4 days or freezing them.
Use them within 4 days or freeze them. All right. Let's talk about truth or false. The different kind of meats you might have. If you were to have, you know, poultry and you're preparing that, you've got beef and you're preparing that. Do you have to keep things apart or use separate plates, or in the cooking process, it doesn't really matter because you're going to cook them anyway. Just don't put them back on the original plates.
So definitely don't put them back on the original plates. You're right with that one. But when it comes to cooking those either together, separate, or at the same time, it really just depends because both of those have a different recommended internal temperature. So poultry has a higher recommended internal temperature than beef does. And unless you want to cook your beef to the safe temperature that turkey has to go to or that your poultry has to go to, you might want to consider keeping them separate. So, you know, if you're going to do them together or going to have them touching beforehand, all of those foods have to go to the highest internal temperature for whichever food you're making. So if you're putting steaks next to chicken breast and they're all touching, they got to go to 165 because that's what the internal temperature is for your chicken breast. If you're going to keep them completely separate, then you can, you know, stick with the normal 145 degrees Fahrenheit with a 3-minute rest time for your beef, for your, you know, veal, lamb, all of your red meats and things, or, and, you know, keep your 165 for your poultry.
All right, if I buy my pumpkin pie at the store, most likely it will not be refrigerated. Should it be refrigerated when I get it home? And what's your thought about pies and things like that?
Yeah, so store-bought pies a lot of times use different preservatives or things that will help keep them safe at, you know, room temperature, keep them a little more shelf-stable. We do recommend refrigerating just because either way, even if it's required for safety or not, it is going to help keep it, you know, fresh for longer and keep the quality nicer for longer. So just popping it in the fridge is a great option if you want to, you know, keep having it, keep having those leftovers for multiple days. If you're making a pie at home and you're not using obviously the same ingredients that people use in the store or any, you know, the commercial setting to try and make it more shelf stable, you are definitely going to want to refrigerate, you know. So store-bought, if you're buying it not refrigerated, you can keep it not refrigerated, but it's going to stay longer in the fridge. Or if you're making it at home, definitely refrigerate.
Okay, let's talk stuffing in the bird or out of the bird. Our family tradition is to stuff it in the bird, but somebody once told me, oh, no, it's much better if you have it, you know, external, and it's not so smart to put it in the bird. Is there anything to that, or is it okay to stuff a bird and cook it?
So it is a bit riskier food safety wise to stuff your turkey, you know, put the stuffing inside the bird. And we try and advise against it just to help keep people as safe as possible. But if you are going to stuff your turkey, there are ways to do that safely. So some of the things to consider there is that putting stuffing inside the bird is, you know, getting that raw poultry juice and stuff on the bird, or sorry, on the stuffing, which is then, you know, creating an environment for bacteria to be on the stuffing. It could start to multiply because that's the last, you know, part of the turkey that's going to start to cook is that total internal part where the stuffing is. So it's possible that, you know, some of that bacteria could be an issue. The other thing is it's going to take the turkey longer to cook because you're now also have that stuffing inside of it, and it might take longer. People might get impatient. You know, people don't always think to check the internal temperature of the stuffing as well with the food thermometer. And if you're not doing that, there's a risk that none of that, you know, that bacteria in the stuffing from the raw poultry juices wouldn't have been killed, and you could potentially get sick from that. So if you are going to put the stuffing in the turkey, it's really important to make sure that you don't stuff it ahead of time, that you're just stuffing it right before you're putting the turkey in the oven, and that you also use a food thermometer to check the center of the stuffing to make sure that has reached a safe internal temperature of 165 degrees as well. And if you do those things and you handle it safely, then it should be fine. Again, we just kind of advise against it to keep people as safe as possible, but totally understand it's tradition for a lot of people to make sure you're using that food thermometer.
All right, here's another one that's controversial. Rinsing out your turkey or not. There's been kind of a double standard on that. You know, people, I've been hearing articles and reading things that say, oh, you poultry, you should never be rinsing things off. You're just spreading potential bacteria around. And other people say, well, come on, it's a turkey cavity. It was probably frozen at one time. You kind of need to make sure it's thawed. You're going to probably rinse it out. What do you tell people?
So similar concept to the stuffing, we, you know, kind of advise against it just because of the risk that comes with it. But, you know, turkeys are really large. Turkeys are really kind of, you know, bulky, and it's hard to maneuver them without, you know, potentially having to do that in the sink. Like you said, a lot of people do that for preference because, you know, the giblets are in there, there's a neck in there, there's, you know, it's been frozen at one point, and people like to rinse that out or pat it dry, etc. So we had tried to advise not to do it because the risk is that you're, you know, once you're rinsing and washing it, bacteria from that raw turkey is spreading into your sink. And then unless you're fully cleaning and sanitizing after, you're going to, you know, start to do other food prep in there. The bacteria can transfer to other food products that may not be eaten later. And if you eat that, you can get sick. So it spreads bacteria, and then have a situation where you really have to clean and sanitize and make sure that you're getting all of the bacteria out of your sink. And then, you know, possibly if it's splattered up on the countertops or anything like that. So if you're going to wash your turkey, like I said, fully clean and sanitize, take a, you know, paper towel or a cloth with water and soap, wipe down the sink basin really well, and then take a sanitizer, either a homemade with 1 tablespoon of bleach to 1 gallon of water, or a commercial sanitizing solution that is safe to use near food contact surfaces, and then wipe down the sink with sanitizer to make sure you're sanitizing it, getting the rest of those germs nice and killed after that.
Okay, now let's talk about the cooking portion. I have never fried a turkey, but people tell me, oh, it's great. And other people say, well, you better get a burn permit, because if you do it wrong, the whole thing can explode. And then I've heard people say, oh, you have to baste your turkey with a big baster. And other people saying, oh, no, that's wrong to do. Give us the do's and don'ts on making a turkey.
So there are tons of ways to make a turkey. You know, like you just mentioned, there's deep frying, there's traditional roasting, there's spatchcocking, which is where you butterfly the bird out, you know, to kind of lay out and have, you know, a faster cooking time. There's tons of different ways to cook turkeys, lots of different preferences on how to cook one with good quality. There's oven bags, there's basting, there's, you know, different seasonings and things. And, as, you know, at the end of the day, no matter how you're cooking it, just, you know, following your 4 steps to food safety and really, you know, trusting your food thermometer, using a food thermometer is a great tool. No matter how you're cooking it, your turkey has to reach a safe internal temperature of 165 degrees. So get a food thermometer, have one on hand. Check it in those three places of the thickest part of the breast, innermost part of the wing, innermost part of the thigh. Make sure it's reached that 165 and it'll be safe to eat. Now, in terms of doing things like deep frying, as you mentioned, there are some personal safety considerations that come with that. For deep frying specifically, you absolutely have to have a fully thawed turkey. If there's any ice crystals or any ice portions still on the turkey, when that hits that hot frying oil, it's going to vaporize and create steam, which could potentially bubble over or splatter. That's sending, you know, 350-degree oil in places where you kind of don't want that to be, no. It could be a fire hazard if it gets on the propane. You don't want it on your skin. So definitely keeping in, you know, that in mind, it has to be fully thawed. If it's not fully thawed, please don't try and put it in the fryer. I promise you it won't end well. And then, you know, as well as making sure that when you're pulling it out, testing the temperature, that you're giving it enough time to cool off a little bit, because again, it's coming out of 350-degree oil. You know, when you're roasting, there are things like the oven bags or basting, which can help make a juicier or, you know, more moist turkey. That's all personal preference for quality. We do have safe recommendations for using something like a cooking bag, specifically making sure you're using a bag specifically for going in the oven. You know, we've had people try and call in asking if they can use a trash bag, and that's not necessarily the purpose of a trash bag. It's not meant to go in the oven.
No.
And so you want to make sure you're using an oven cooking bag.
Yeah.
Something that's meant to go in the oven at those temperatures. Yeah, again, they're all, you know, mostly for quality, and there are some safety considerations with them. But
So if I want to balance getting the temperature right with it being done but not being dried out, are there things to watch for, like, somebody told me the other day, oh, why don't you flip your turkey over? And that way gravity will pull the oils through the breast and keep that moist, because sometimes it doesn't get that way. Somebody else said, oh, well, the wing should start to fall off if it's really done. Is there a set and fast rule here, or number of minutes per pound?
That's very interesting, the one about flipping it upside down. I've never heard of that one before. But yeah, you know, some turkeys have a pop-up timer, which, you know, pop-up timers are accurate. They're great and offensive, giving you a guide on when that breast part might start to reach a safe internal temperature. And of course, you would still recommend using your thermometer to double check that, and then also checking the two additional places. But sometimes the pop-up timer, if your turkey has one, could be a good indicator. We do have roasting recommendations and other cooking recommendations in terms of time per pound on our website. If anybody wants to go look at those, of course, it depends on how big it is and what temperature you're putting at. But, you know, we do have some of those recommendations on how long it'll take. So you can use that time frame as a guide. Start, you know, checking it with the food thermometer. That's another great way to tell. You know, of course, if you pull it out and it's still at 140, you know, you got to get it to 165, you're going to have to put it back in. But keeping those in mind of, you know, not trying to go overtime or trying to estimate as best as possible while also using your food thermometer are great ways to make sure you're getting a tasty turkey, but also a steak.
Give us the website.
So our website is www.ssis.usda.gov. FSIS stands for Food Safety and Inspection Service. So we also do have a meat and poultry hotline, which has food safety experts like myself available to answer any of your questions. And we are also open on Thanksgiving Day. So if you have any turkey chaos or turkey issues or need to talk turkey on Thanksgiving Day, we're open from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Phone at 1-888-MT-HOTLINE, so 1-888-674-6854.
Take care.
Yeah, of course. Have a great day and a great holiday.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.